I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're recording on today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I extend my respect to their elders past, present and emerging, and any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listeners that we have joining us. Sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
If I knew my career was going to be terminated the way it did, I would have worked harder. I made a commitment to the family, the foster parents and the biological parents that I'd do everything humanly possible to find out, you know, what happened to William, and when that was taken away, that doesn't sit well.
In this episode, we get to know Gary Jubelin, household name, iconic Australian homicide detective and now journalist and host of the top-ranking podcast, I Catch Killers. Gary's journey began in the 1980s with the New South Wales Police Force, where he quickly rose through the ranks. He became renowned for his relentless pursuit of justice, notably the Bowraville murders case, which spanned over two decades and publicly showcased his unwavering commitment to the families of three Indigenous children. Gary was assigned the infamous case of William Tyrrell, one that still remains open. Today, we dive deeper into Gary's life away from the force, as well as hearing more about the compelling murders he dedicated his life to pursuing, and of course, we cover his controversial departure from the police force. This one was definitely a career highlight for me. Thank you so much, Gary. Let's get into the chat. This is Life Chats. Deep and meaningful conversations with friends and strangers. Let's just kick off. You've been coined at one point Australia's most celebrated homicide detective. Does that feel like an uncomfortable title?
Yeah, most definitely. And I hear it used a fair bit. And I understand people like to put labels on things, celebrated, infamous, all sorts of things I think you could add to it. But look, I understand why it's used. I've got a profile. I accept that. And the nature of the work that I did and some of the cases I worked on, it's nothing you sort of strive for. But when it's mentioned, sometimes I cringe because policing is a very much a team sport. Mm-hmm. And quite often you get identified as being involved in a particular case because you might be leading it. And I understand that because I worked on cases where other people were leading it and you didn't get the recognition. But I'm very mindful of paying tribute to all the people that worked on these cases with me during my time in the police.
Why do you think that your profile grew rapidly? Do you think it was just a situation with the cases that you worked on were high profile, or was there something about your personality that seemed to kind of take off and media liked having you weigh in on things? Like, how do you see your career playing out the way it did?
Yeah, I think very much the cases that I worked, like some of the particular cases, they were high profile, and I spent 25 years investigating homicides. So the majority of the cases that I worked that people don't hear of or heard of but didn't know I was involved in it. The high profile ones sort of put you in the public spotlight. I think there's, if anything, when I do speak to the media, I think it's genuine. I think, I see some police speak there and nothing to see here, ma'am. Inquiries are continuing, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think I adopted the approach that you've got to work with the media. That's what I was taught when I was a young detective, that media plays a role in investigations. So I would use the media to for a purpose, whether that be to just notify the public, give the public confidence, or flush out the bad guys. So that, and then of course there was the Underbelly TV series that, and I know I was looked at differently after that. And that was
how did you feel about that all happening? Were you kind of approached and asked on, to help develop that, or
yeah? What happened with that? Senior police, so the Underbelly writers spoke to senior police. And I think the Underbelly series before that had given the police a bit of a kicking, the corruption in King's Cross and that. And senior police said, well, why don't you do something positive about what the police do? That after the Royal Commission, after all the corruption, there are still police out there doing some tough jobs. And it just so happened I was doing one of the biggest jobs in the state or country at the time, the murder of Terry Falconer. And so the producers, writers got permission from senior police, and they were allowed to come in and speak to myself and my staff. And then that I became a little bit uncomfortable about that, like having writers sit beside you while you're investigating. So it was agreed that I'd just do it on my own time. So, look, I enjoyed the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Policing in itself is a very negative environment, and it was good working with creative people. The flow on or the fallout from that, I say it's jealousy because I say jealousy not because I've done anything, I'll just clarify that, not because I think I'm anything special. But I think the majority of people, if they're being honest with themselves, would love a TV series made about the work that they're doing.
Totally. And it's a celebration and a commendation of what you've been doing.
100%. And there was a lot of people that, oh, well, look at him or that. But the hardworking detectives, the ones that I respected, they were happy for me. They said, because they know it could have been anyone. It just happened to be that investigation. But after that, I felt like I had a bit of a target on my back. It was beneficial in certain ways because the crooks knew who I was. So if I was heading up the investigation, there was, I won't say respect, but there was acknowledgement, oh, this bloke knows what he's doing. In the witness box at court, the barristers would love to make a name for themselves and bash up the underbelly guy.
The TV detective.
TV detective. So there was a bit of that. It's a double-edged sword. But when it's all said and done, I was very proud of that investigation, what myself and the team did. It was a 10-year investigation and we had it in the thick of it and we got good results from it.
Totally. And it's not like you wrote the TV show about yourself. It's not like you put forward your own TV show.
It's funny you should say that, Georgia, because I've had some arguments with people when they've sort of thrown it at me and they've gone, what did you think? I went and
presented a script.
Channel 9, here, do a show about me. And the funny part about that show, when other people were portrayed in it, they got cranky at me because they didn't like the actor that was portraying them or whatever. And I'm thinking, are you for real? And everyone's little egos were, people say they don't pay attention to it, but I can assure you it was. And there was some funny times. I made a good friendship. Matt Nable, who played me, we've become good friends and we stay in touch. So, it was an interesting period of time.
You just mentioned ego. Do you think policing has a lot of egos involved? Because it obviously can be quite a celebrated industry or force when you are great at your job. You get a lot of public recognition, you're serving the people. Do you think that the people that are very high up in the police force in your experience, and obviously you don't have to throw anyone under the bus, is there just a sense of bravado and I guess ego?
I think there's a sense of self-importance at the higher level in that like a military structure, there's rank and you respect the person above you and you have control of the people under you. And you've got authority as a police officer. I've often wondered, because I'm not the only one that the police have turned on, like what happened to me when I left my career. I had so many other police go, that happened to me, that happened to me. And I've been thinking about it for a long time and this is my take on it. And I'm not a psychologist, obviously.
Okay.
It's just a theory.
Yeah.
But I think with police, you're given a certain amount of respect by the public because you're a police officer. That's your identity. So when you're out in public or just socialising, you're a police officer. That gives you a certain power and a certain degree of respect. Then you put us all together and we cancel each other out. So everyone's got a gun. Everyone's got a badge. We're all police. So if someone rises above there, they tried to drag them down. Because I've been trying to work out the psychology of why we turn on our own so much.
Also, Australians tend to do that. It's the whole tall poppy thing. Like we say we want to celebrate people who are successful, but I think it fundamentally does make us feel a little bit uncomfortable when someone, like a friend or a family member or someone close to you is very successful. It makes us question our own sort of worth, I think.
I think so. And I think like with policing, everyone's got that respect because you're a police officer. But if someone, and I'm not talking about myself here, I'm just talking about anyone rises above that, others get why is she or he getting all the recognition? So, and I was a commissioned officer when I retired, but I think they lose their way of what their job is about. It's not developing your own career. It's about, you're a public servant foremost, and that's a pretty simple term, public servant. You're there to serve the public, and I think they lose sight of that sometimes in their ambition to get to the top.
Totally. I've got in my notes, like, I think what sets you apart, and you've spoken about it quite openly, is the fact that you believe the number one trait of a successful detective is empathy. And that's something that surprises people, because some people see police officers as aggressive and forceful and, you know, not kind, empathetic people, but you are. I imagine you got into this industry and you got into the police force because you wanted to help people.
Yeah. And look, I think, well, I'll preface that with, I got in the police because it looked like an exciting job.
You saw someone running down the street, I believe.
But I learnt as I went along the impact that crime has on people. And I was at the sharp end of fighting crime as a detective or on the streets. That was my thing in policing, and there's plenty of different roles. But it's funny, since I've left the police and I get to sit down, have chats with police, and the word empathy comes out from a lot of people that I respect, and I wouldn't expect it. Like I'm thinking I've identified empathy because I think that helps you in policing, and that certainly helped me understand, you know, when I'm dealing with victims, and the majority of my career in homicide, so it was very victim orientated. Empathy goes a long way. Just that the people know, even if you're not successful in solving the crime, they know you care, and that little bit of understanding means so much. So all the good detectives I know, all of them, bar none, have got that empathy, and they can come across as tough guys or hard women or whatever, but when you scratch the surface, they've retained that humanity.
That must be quite challenging to do, and I would love to know, how do you find empathy for someone who, I've heard you use the words, you know, you've sat across from pure evil. There are people in this world that might not have any good in them. How on earth do you cling on to empathy in those moments? Yeah.
There are some people, and there's degrees, there are some people that I throw the empathy out the door.
Right.
And only a small percentage, only a very small percentage. There's some violent criminals that I've dealt with that on the surface you couldn't see how I could have a relationship or have some respect or whatever. But when you hear people's stories, how they got to that point, I think if I grew up in that environment, some of the criminals that I've been speaking to since I've left the police, because I've got more time sort of delving into how did you get here rather than I've got you and then move on to the next one, it has blown me away by, Jesus, if I had an upbringing like that, I reckon I'd be where you are.
Mm-hmm.
The only ones I don't give empathy for is the ones that certain serial killers, well, for obvious reasons, where children are victims, and we're all very protective of that. But the thing about children is that they should be protected. And anyone that preys on children like pedophiles or that, I haven't got sympathy for them. And am I a hypocrite because I talk about empathy?
No,
but
I don't think so.
I think you've got to draw the line somewhere, and that's where I draw the line.
Totally. Speaking of that, I mean, I imagine it takes a huge mental health toll, or it did throughout your career, you know, spending days and hours and weeks and months on cases and years with these people that are not the greatest humans.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? Do you compartmentalize? Do you knowingly do it? Is it a skill set that can be developed? I guess I'm just interested to hear about, for you personally, was there a mental health toll, and how did you kind of process the things that you were seeing and hearing?
Look, I don't think I've got a mental health. People close to me might go, you're kidding, you lunatic.
Your kids are probably listening going, oh, gosh.
I think I'm fine. It does take its toll, and people deal with things differently. The way, and I'm just trying to process it or understand how I got through all that time where I think I've come out, not anger, not resentment, and not mental health issues. The way I channeled my energy when I was in those bad cases was I had a job to do. So at a crime scene, at a murder scene, I wouldn't necessarily put a life into the body, not at the scene. I'm thinking, oh, that poor person. I'm thinking, okay, this is my job. What's the next step? So I'd be very methodical in that. Sometimes you'd get home and it'd sort of hit you and go, oh, that was horrible. Or the phone rings and you think, oh, I hope I'm not going to another, a murder. So that plays on it. I think I had I've still got it. It's just part of me that a good bounce back. Like I could hit a low point and then go, okay, well, get back up and keep going. And that's not saying I'm better coping mechanism than the other person, because everyone, it affects everyone differently. I've worked with some great cops and I've seen it. It's just hit them and all of a sudden they've got nothing left in the tank. And I respect that and understand that. But for me, my mechanisms was training. I always train and that helps my mental health. Like no matter how down I am about or focused about work, if I go out and flog myself training, it sort of takes my mind off it. And I do, soft training as well. So I do meditation and yoga and a thing called Qigong.
I love Qigong, yeah.
Yeah, well, I got drawn to that about 25, 30 years ago. Couldn't understand what the fascination was, but I kept coming back to it. Got very much into it and it helped me during different times in that it was sort of in my back pocket I could go to if I was sort of, when I say spinning out, sometimes when you're working in a chaotic environment that policing can be, you're operating at a different pace and you know you're out of step because you walk out on the street or you come home and people aren't, you know, it just doesn't
like
feel
right.
Like
the nervous systems are just very different
levels. Yeah, you're hyper alert. Mm. So with Qigong and meditation, I could just bring that down and go, okay, I know what I've got to do. Mm. So that was sort of in my back pocket to use when I needed to use, and it's been very, very helpful.
Those are, I guess, tools, yoga, meditation, Qigong, they're quite grounded in like spiritual practice.
Yep.
Do you define yourself or label yourself as a spiritual person?
I'm not a spiritual person in that I haven't hung my hat on a particular religion or that, but then I've had people close to me saying you are spiritual in your own way. And I look for, you know, I look for purpose, I look for meaning. Is that spiritual? You know,
how do you
define it? But I don't adhere to one particular religion, but I might take little snippets from different things and think, okay. And I like to, when I say surround myself, sometimes it's not the case, but learn from some people that are very, you meet these people who are very Zen-like and are wise and they have this wisdom. And sometimes I just try and take a little bit away from that and, okay, well, that might make me a better person because my philosophy in life, and it doesn't always work because we all stuff up, but I try to be a better person each day. Like I'm trying to improve and like what I did 10 years, I think I'm a better person than I was 10 years ago. And yeah, hopefully in 10 years time, I'll be a better person still. You've become wiser and yeah.
It's such a great lifelong pursuit because you never arrive at like an end point. There's always work to be done. You can always be kinder, be better, be healthier, you know, all those things you can always improve on. But something you just touched on, you're not spiritual. I'm interested in how your work informed or still informs, you know, with the podcast and the conversations that you have, your view on the world, because I have friends who are in the police force and family, and they have said things like you start to have a skewed perception on reality, or you start to see the world in a way that it might not be because you're only seeing the darkest side of humanity and you start to think that that's all there is. I guess, does that ring true for you? And if so, how do you kind of bring yourself back to a sense of balance and kind of perception of reality?
You've got to be, I think, self-aware of it. And most definitely you can become hardened. If I'm working on a particular type of investigation that might be an aggressive investigation, so I'm talking to people and I'm saying some cutting things and, yeah, I can be nasty. I can bring that out. Then you might be at the shop, buying something at the shop, and the shopkeeper does something wrong and you say something and you think, oh, you horrible, horrible human being. And you might, it might be something simple. I just pluck this out of the air, like, are you right? Are you ready to serve me or something? And you think, where did that come from? That poor kid's there just trying to earn money. And you walk out of the store and you think, you're a dickhead. And that's where I try to check myself on that and not bring that in. Now, whether policing had that impact on me or whether that was just in my nature, I don't know. But I think policing magnifies it because... Yeah, sometimes I go to work and I used to joke with people, sometimes I wish I was a florist. And that sounds sad in that when you go to work as a cop, invariably all the work I was doing, I was going to upset someone's day. That was basically my job. Someone was going to be upset and that's the nature of the work. And sometimes I'd wake up and think, wouldn't it be good to go to work and just, or a travel agent, here, go on this lovely holiday, or here, have these flowers.
Yeah.
Just something without the confrontation. And you become good at confrontation, but I don't go looking for it. And I always walk away from confrontation feeling a little bit less of myself because you've got to, but yeah, that is your job as a policeman. Like I can't sit down opposite someone that I think's done a horrendous crime and not go hard. And I'm not talking breaking rules, but I'm talking about I'm going to have the hard, honest conversation.
Yeah, I heard you speaking to Aunt Middleton about the feeling of like dirtiness that you can have after having those conversations. And I guess what I'm interested to hear is like, is there any sort of sense of relief now that you don't have to do that on a day-to-day basis?
It's an interesting question. I do feel like I'm a lighter person.
Wow.
Yeah. Because it's not all confrontation. And policing was confrontation. It's a contact sport. And so I definitely feel like I can stop and smell the roses and look, oh, it's a nice day. And sometimes I wake up and think, how good's this? Yeah, that I'm not in that world anymore.
You probably lose sight as to how intense it is when you're in it, I imagine, too. Now you're out of it, you can kind of see it differently.
Yeah. You don't have perspective when you're in there. That's just the world that you know. So it's bang, you're into it. Mm-hmm. What I really enjoy is when I go to sleep at night and knowing the phone's not going to ring, because I hadn't had that for 25 years. And I didn't realize how much that impacts on you, because no matter where you are or what you're doing, and you could be having the, you know, nicest time, and then the phone rings, and then you're back into work mode, or
like being on family holidays and having to come home, or I imagine missing kids' events or all sorts of things.
All of that, missed family holidays, or on a holiday when you're not really on the holiday because you're worried because you haven't got connection on your phone, and you're sitting up in the tree trying to get connection, and just all sorts of shit that went down. And I look back, and like I've said this to people too, and I say it publicly, that people had to give me space to do that. Like I had to be selfish in my private life to be able to do what I achieved in policing, to commit to the policing as much as I did. But the joy of not worrying about the phone ringing, I still challenge myself on things. So I still feel the pressure, but just I feel like I own myself again, if that makes sense.
Totally. I imagine you just would have felt like you're in a constant state of stress and at the whims of and the mercy of your job. You didn't have any probably control or autonomy. It was like, you're sent here, do this, do that. So I guess I'd love to ask you, you know, with all the sacrifice and that stress and that toll, was it worth it? Do you look back and think, I missed, you know, the family holidays, or I missed being present? Do you feel like it was worth it, or do you wish that you could go back and change things a little?
Sometimes I think, was it worth it because of the sacrifices, the way it changed me and the impact it had on people close to me? But then I think the respect and saying love is not putting it too high from the families of victims of crimes that I worked on. And, you like to think you do something in life and it's a little bit meaningful. Yeah. I'm not the perfect person, but I think I did good in my policing, and I know there's families that I helped because I made those sacrifices. So I walk away from it the way my career ended. You know, people say it's ended in disgrace, shame and all that. I feel so proud of my career, and I stand by everything I did in my my career. And, the support I've got from people that I haven't heard of from a long time, when I got into trouble, they were getting in contact with me, and it meant so much. And falsely, I believe, I had some friendships in policing that you could hear the crickets whistle when they just weren't around, and that disappointed me. That hurt me. So I look back, I wish I didn't invest time in people that I thought we were this brotherhood,
like a family almost.
In the policing, and it's made me see the reality of that. Having said that, I've got some great friends from policing that have been rock solid and supported me, but there's been others. I think, why do they even waste time on you?
It's hard, because I imagine that's true for so many industries as well. What you're reflecting on, that to be highly successful, you have to make sacrifices.
Yeah.
That's true for so many different industries, particularly when you're public facing as well. So I'm sure many people feel the same way, but I think what made me quite emotional was, you know, looking over material and watching videos and whatnot and seeing the families of so many victims at the courthouse when you went up the stairs. Like that, I don't know why, just particularly watching that happen, was it just struck a chord for me that you were there for these people during their time of need and they wanted to return the favour.
It honestly just blew me away. Mm. And that was the worst time of my life. Like we're Sydney based here, where we're doing the podcast. I walked from Central Railway Station down in Centre Court with cameras in my face the whole time. And we're talking probably a kilometre. It was humiliating. Mm. I couldn't believe the attention that was thrown on that. And I walk up there and I'm thinking, how am I going to deal with this? And I walked up the stairs and there were all these family members and all that chanting out my name. And all of a sudden it just changed my focus on it. I thought, okay, this is bad what you're going through, but you've got nothing to whinge about. The other thing that puts it in perspective, what happened to me in leaving the police, is that I've seen what these families have gone through.
And you're on the other side now.
Yeah, but what I've gone through compared to what they went through, losing loved ones and that, like, it's, I got no, I can't whinge.
I actually was, I just really admire, I heard you in an interview say, if it took you losing your career to bring light and bring justice for the Tyrrell family, you'd do it again. Like, you'd do it 1,000 times
yeah,
over.
Yeah, 100%. And people ask me about that, what's my regrets on the Tyrrell matter, and I get criticised for going too hard on some people, too soft on others. Mm. If I knew my career was going to be terminated the way it did, I would have worked harder.
Yeah. You would have been more extreme.
Because I made a commitment to the family, the foster parents and the biological parents, that I'd do everything humanly possible to find out, you know, what happened to William, and when that was taken away, that doesn't sit well.
Do you still think about it?
Yeah, there's not a day that goes past that I don't think about it, or where someone talks about it to me. You know, it's linked to that matter no matter what, and it breaks my heart that we still haven't got answers for the family. We still don't know what's happened to William, and we've all seen the image, and I think that's why it resonated with so many people. The iconic photo of young William in his Spider-Man suit, and every time I see a Spider-Man suit, it sort of hits you. But I just feel for the families. They need answers, and hopefully answers will come.
Speaking of that sort of concept of being kept up at night, or, you know, cases that I guess might still quote unquote haunt you, are there any others that, any maybe unsolved cases or cases that you can't seem to let go of?
Look, any case you work on that you haven't solved, that sits with you. You're always thinking, did we miss something, or could have I done that? The Bowerville matters is because the families are like family to me, and people go, you get too close. And I go, you should... Try and not get close to people you've worked to trying to get justice for the past, quarter of a century. I still stay in contact with them. I see them, and I'm hoping that they get justice. It just seems ridiculous that they can't, but there's a whole lot of factors playing in. The fact that they're Aboriginal impacted on it right from the start, and I think it still carries through to this day.
Can we speak a little bit about Bowerville? I would love to know how that case changed you as a human, not just as a police officer. Yeah.
It showed me that, first of all, it called me on my own unconscious bias and racism that I didn't realise I had. I went up there naive in that I thought, I'm not racist, I know that. But I had this preconceived ideas on the way things should happen. I came up into the Bowerville community as a hotshot homicide detective from the city dressed in his suit, and I got crowd by the community. They did a pretty good job on me. And it changed me realising that, you've got to respect the environment in which you work. So that's the first thing. The racism that played a part in that, the lack of response to when the three children were murdered, and the ongoing, not just at the time, the ongoing. And I'm not criticising individuals here. This was a whole, the system let them down. The media weren't interested in it. The police didn't properly resource it. The courts didn't do what they could for it in every aspect. Mm-hmm. So I naively thought, it didn't matter in this country who you were, what race, how, whether you're rich or poor, but I realised that justice is not equal for everyone. Mm-hmm. And if you're like the Bowerville community, not just an Aboriginal community, but socioeconomically disadvantaged, they just didn't have the support or the response they should have. So it's changed me. And because I've remained friendly with so many of the community, I've learnt that when they talk to me about how things impact on them, I really feel like I've got a sense of it. And the respect that they've shown to me, it just blows me away. I get emotional just thinking about some of the things that they have done out of respect for me. And so when people go, well, how have you worked on a case for that long? I'm telling you, I got more from that case than they got from me.
I imagine that you say they did so much for you. I imagine that's in a direct response to how you treated them and what you were willing to do to try and bring justice to these families. So it sounds like a really pivotal and informative experience in your career.
It made me a better person, that honestly did. I'm proud that on the back of a parliamentary inquiry, they first recommendation was that I do a training film for the New South Wales Police on dealing with Indigenous communities. I have heard that my face is now pixelated out of that.
No.
I've heard it from a couple of sources.
That's odd.
I hope it's not true, but anyway.
You need to get a copy of that video somehow.
Yeah, that would be a bit bizarre, wouldn't it?
Wow.
But I'm proud of it, and it's changed me in the way that it's made me a better person. And, it's really made me check myself, like if I've got any racist tones. And I call it unconscious bias because sometimes we've got it and we don't even realise it. So they've made me a better person, 100%. And I think they also brought home to me throughout my career the importance of making sure you look after victims during investigations.
You just touched on it before. You said it was it's a systemic issue. Obviously, the system let them down. Whether it be Bowerville or other cases that you worked on, and I don't know if you're going to want to answer this, do you think that we have a broken system? Do you think that policing is a broken system?
Look, I think there's some great police. I wouldn't say policing's broken. There's always room for improvement. Mm-hmm. I think we've got to focus on, to me, I'll answer it this way, and I'm avoiding a little bit, but I think police should be judged on providing the community what the community want. They're there to serve the community. So if the community are happy with the police are doing their job. Mm-hmm. I think we lose track of it. You know, we're trying to run police stations on a profit or, you know, ridiculous things. Like I say to people when I was working on investigations as a detective chief inspector, part of my role was to check that car diaries were added up correctly. And like, I'm telling you.
Surely not.
No, wow. True. So I would be spending time checking car diaries and making sure that the car, and I understand that you need that, but I just think my skills and those of other police could be better utilised somewhere else. And I understand the need for compliance and all that because a place can fall apart and corruption can come in from it. But the irony was never lost on me when I'm sitting there adding up a car diary when I'm trying to juggle all these investigations and my maths wasn't that good to start with. So I'm just, yeah.
So those books were not balanced, no.
Don't tell them that. I'll get into trouble.
I guess off the back of that, and again, you don't have to answer, but if you could pinpoint, like, what do you think were the main barriers to conducting successful investigations? Do you think it was resources and not having enough money? Do you think it was political factors? Do you think it was internal politics, I suppose, office politics? Like, in your experience, I guess, what frustrated you about the way that the system is built?
You always want more resources, but I understand resources are limited. The way, and I don't want to be, because it's hard to generalise like the system being broken, because I can guarantee there's some great detectives out there now doing some brilliant investigations and at the moment. So I think the importance is the early times. If I talk homicide, because that's my area of expertise, if resources are put into the investigation right at the start, first 48 hours bit, that's very true. And I think you can point it in the right direction. I would just like to see police be able to focus on policing and not get caught up in the management system. And I know we need managers, but perhaps they could work. I see like with the military, they have the operational soldiers and then they have the career path. I think we need to do something along those lines. But good policing comes down to the individual. And I think everyone's got the experience of walking into a police station to perhaps report a crime and they've met a police officer that has just gone above and beyond. And it changes your whole view on policing. So I don't adhere to we need more police. I just think we need to utilise the police better. And, I go for quality over quantity, if that makes sense. Like on a strike force, I wanted people that I could rely on a strike force and give me five good people rather than 20 average people. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd get better results.
Hi, everyone. A quick reminder that if you are loving this chat, I would be so grateful if you could take 2 minutes now to jump on whatever platform you're listening to this and leave a review or share the episode you're currently listening to on social media. I'd love to see where you're listening from, if you're going for a walk, if you're at the gym on the treadmill, if you're driving. Obviously, don't take a photo if you're driving. But it is so incredible to see that we now have listeners from over 35 countries tuning in. And the more that we grow, the bigger guests I can bring you. I am so, so grateful that you're here on this journey with me. And I'm excited about the life chats that we have coming up with some absolutely inspiring guests. Thank you so much. Something that you mentioned at the start of the episode was that you felt like you had a little bit of a target on your back off the back of maybe these high-profile cases or a range of different factors. And I'd particularly like to know at this point of, you know, you've done Bowraville, it's ongoing, then there's the William Tyrrell case. I guess at this point it's been 2-3 decades in the police force.
Yep.
What does that feel like to kind of feel like you're doing your job, you're doing your best, but perhaps you're coming up against people or personalities that are questioning your intentions or challenging what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I definitely had a target on my back with the William Tyrrell matter.
At what point did you realise that?
When I was being cautioned and warrants were being executed on me.
It was a bit of a blindside, was it?
Yes, within reason. I knew I didn't have support from certain people, but I never thought it would eventuate to what it became. So if I have to accept some criticism, I probably should have aligned myself with more people of power, but that's not the way I went about my business. I did what I thought was right, and that piss people off, so therefore at the crucial times you mightn't get people supporting you. I accept that. That's the price I've got to pay. I just think it was an overreaction, what happened with the William Tyrrell matter and the way it was leaked to the media about details, and this is just the tip of the iceberg and that type of stuff. Really, when it was all said and done, shouldn't the focus been not taking out me but finding out what happened to William Tyrrell?
And not sabotaging the case by leaking details as well.
Yeah, 100%. And so that's left me with a sour taste. If people don't like me and it's time to move on, I could move on with no animosity. And I think that's what people didn't understand. The people that bought the actions against me, they thought they'd break me by taking policing away from me. It hurt me. It hurt me a great deal. It's what I loved. It was my passion. That's what I did. But I never thought that I was defined by being a police officer. I thought I could make it on the outside. See how indoctrinated you are on the outside.
Yeah, the language.
But I thought I could make it on the outside. I just chose policing because I loved doing what I was doing, and I had a passion for it. So I reflect on it and, yeah, should I have done things differently? Well, I would have had to play their game, and that's not me. I'm comfortable that I've stood by what I believe in, and I'm prepared to pay the price for those beliefs.
I think that kind of says it all, that you're happy to own what happened and that you wouldn't change it. And I imagine it must be a quite a relieving process to be able to speak about it now and not clear your name, because I think that just your work speaks for itself, but be able to talk about the impact of that emotionally and I guess having to redefine your identity.
Yeah, and allegations are made against you, convictions were recorded against me, fines were paid. You know, the court has decided I was wrong. I'm not ashamed of what I've done in policing, and I'm not going to hide behind the fact what I did. I never said, I put my hand up. I explained why, and the courts didn't accept it. But walking away from it, I think the way that I'm not going to be broken by it, and I think there was certain people that were hoping, and I had senior police tell me to go off sick. Yeah, well, I haven't had sick leave. I'm not going off on sick leave. Yeah, I'll turn up for work. And then the life that I've found for myself after working in the media and doing what I'm doing, I'm finding it very enjoyable. And I also find that I'm doing something worthwhile. Like I'm not choosy in what I chose to do outside of policing. There was a lot of offers that were given to me, and I just chose ones that I thought would be worthwhile and that I'd be proud of.
Totally. Another question before we move on is just around that whole situation. And again, no pressure to answer, but are there ever, in your opinion, maybe you don't have to use personal experience to answer this, are there situations in the police force or detective work where the end is justified by the means, and perhaps things are done that aren't quite legal or by the book?
Yeah.
But I know culturally it has changed. We used to have people admit things off record and all these things that have now changed. There are systems in place. But I guess I'm asking, were you kind of frustrated knowing that maybe things like this had happened before but no one had ever been charged for it?
Yeah, well, it's... First of all, right from day one in the academy, it's drummed into you about the ends don't justify the means.
Right.
And I think it's a cornerstone of good policing. Mm. We've got to accept that. I was in major crime before the Royal Commission, the Wood Royal Commission in New South Wales Police Corruption, and I saw a lot of people come unstuck during that time. if anything, that gave me an appreciation of, you know, if you bend one rule and then, okay, your moral compass slips a little bit, then you bend another one, and then all of a sudden you're this rogue cop or, you know, corrupt detective. So I'm a big believer you're doing a disservice in bending the rules so the ends justify the means. People misconceive me in that I am a hard detective. I put my hand up. You don't want me coming after you. I'm going to come hard. And I'm that's the way I operate.
Yep.
But I didn't break the rules because that is, you break the rules, you potentially jeopardise the whole investigation. So,
and your career, which you've worked so hard for at that point.
And so that's not, you're not achieving anything. So if you want to talk a tough guy, I'm going to do this and do that, just be professional and do your job. And so that's the way I approach it. So I, in answer to the question, and I'd caution any police with this, that, you know, the ends don't justify the means, and it's a slippery slope if you start looking at doing things those ways. Having said that, people have got to understand that when we investigate murders, people just don't walk into the police station and go, hey, I've done it. So
big sign over here, it was me. Yeah.
So I think we've got to acknowledge the work that we've done, and, it can damage people and be brutal, not physically brutal, but it can be, you've really got to go hard. And that's just part and parcel of policing. And, what do you want from society? Do you want police to go hard? And I sort of look at things from the major league offenders, because that's where I work most of my career. Do you want police to go hard, or do you want us to just go, well, we got nothing here?
Can't fix that one, yeah.
Because no matter what you do, you put someone before the court, you're going to get criticised by their defence, and they're paid to criticise you. Mm. And I've said this with young police, because I see sometimes young police were a little bit, as I was as a young police officer, a little bit worried going in the witness box, and then if we charge, we're going to get criticised, and that's part and parcel of it. And you've got to have thick skin for that, because you get in the witness box, you can have done nothing wrong. And I tell you, you're going to get so confused by this barrister being paid $10,000 a day to make you look stupid. You're starting
you're
to
gonna
think
be gaslit into thinking, what did you do wrong?
I've gone into the witness box thinking, I know every question this bloke's going to ask or this lady's going to ask. I'm thinking, I've got the answers. And the moment I get in there, they ask a question, I think, geez, that's a good question.
And you can't exactly say, I don't know.
And so it's difficult, and it is adversarial, it's confrontational. That's the court system. And I think for policing, you just got to be a little bit robust about it, knowing that you're going to get criticised. And I'm probably a little bit more sensitive to it now that I'm out of the police. When I was in the police, people are always going to criticise police, but I was in that police family. Now, if the criticism, I feel like I'm on my own, and it's sort of hung out and that. So that hurts.
Just on your methodology, last question here. Do you, or would you say that throughout your career, you seem like a very pragmatic person and someone who looks at facts and kind of looks at the bigger picture.
Yeah.
But I also am interested to hear that, you do have this maybe spiritual side, whatever people want to label it as. And that often is tied to like a sense of intuition or gut feeling. And I guess I'd love to know, throughout your career, did you ever rely, or obviously you need more than a gut feeling, but did you ever have hunches that you listened to? Were they right or wrong? And is that methodology. Thank you so much. Would that be something that you would stand by?
I think emotional intelligence gives you a bit of an insight into human behaviour. So if you've got emotional intelligence, that helps to a degree. The instinct, you develop that over the years. Like, you sit opposite people that you could sit there and smile and go, no, I didn't do it. Now, if I brought someone in sitting beside me that's not a police officer, you might convince that person. But I've seen that 1,000 times, so I'm not going to fall for just someone.
Do you read random strangers now? Like, have you been unknowingly reading my body language or trying to read how I feel in a situation just through your training?
Too much so. And it's not, when I say training, it's more you develop it, like you get taught limited skills in the academy or detectives training or degrees that you do through uni. But it's that day-to-day thing. But the thing is, with instinct, hunch, or whatever you want to call it, what I've always said is it can help point you in the right direction, because I could walk into a room or come to get a statement from you, and I'll walk out and go, there was something that wasn't quite right
off there.
Yeah, something. I don't really buy into what you just told me. So then we might focus a little bit more on you. But you've got to be careful to make sure that you're instinct and your gut feeling is overlaid with the facts. Mm. So it might point you in the direction, but yeah, the facts are the things that are going to get you across the line.
Was your instinct ever very, very wrong or very, very right in any circumstances?
Yeah, I've in both. Yes, to both sides.
Both, yeah. Yeah.
There was one particular one and a murder. It was a brutal murder, and there was a fella that not only our instinct on it, like he was lying, he was ingratiating himself into the investigation. He had a past history of sexually assaulting old ladies, and this was a murder of an old lady that an elderly lady that had been sexually assaulted. He had links to church that this lady went to, mm-hmm. was in the area. Everything told me that that was him. And I was a junior on that one. My partner at the time, Jim Williams, a great detective, he was my mentor in the early days. And we would late at night be looking through it. That's him. It has to be him. Has to be him. This is just when DNA has come in. So this is going back, you know, very early. There was semen at the scene and we got DNA, and so it was a matter of getting DNA of this person to match that, and then we've got all this circumstantial evidence and then we've got the DNA and, yeah, home and hosed.
Yeah.
We got the DNA and it wasn't his DNA. And
we've
just gone, what is this crappy science sort of thing? Yeah, like really, really looked at it and thought this is wrong. And we went to the laboratory so they could explain it all to us and show us how the tests were done. And it turned out he wasn't the person. We caught the actual killer. Mm. But that taught me so much about not being careful. What I won't say tunnel vision, because you need tunnel vision when you're focusing on someone, but you've got to focus very sharply on that person. Then if that person's been excluded, then move on to the next person and focus there.
Yep.
Keep an open mind, but tunnel vision on the person you're working on at the time. But that taught me that just make sure, because the last thing you want to do as a police officer is charge a person that's innocent. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, based on the evidence we had at the time, if it wasn't the DNA, we would have put the person before the court, and I think there'd be a possibility of that person being convicted.
Wow.
And so that really taught me that what we do is so, the stakes are high and you've got to be very careful.
Totally. Let's jump to, we've spoken a lot about your career as a police officer. I'm aware, or a detective, I know that you're more than that. You've said yourself, you always thought that you were more than that. Talk me through a little bit about the process of resigning, I guess the court case finalising, and then redefining your identity or being able to explore that again. Like who is Gary outside of your role as a detective?
Okay. It made me, you know, just recalibrate a lot of things about what I was doing, because I always thought that was my identity as a cop. I knew within myself I could make it outside world of policing, but when that was taken away from me, and it was taken away from me dramatically, like my last couple of days as operational police officer, two police had been shot over the weekend. And so over the weekend I was flown up to the northwest of the state to oversee that investigation. Mm-hmm. I come back that weekend, and the Monday I went up to Newcastle because there's a murder up there. I'm overseeing that investigation. And then Tuesday afternoon was when my world collapsed, when warrants were served on me and my phones were taken. So it was a dramatic cutoff. Like I wasn't thinking anything else other than, yeah, well, this is what I do. I'm a cop. And so I'm walking out of police headquarters without my gun and
no phone,
no keys, and you know, trying to work out how I'm going to get home. And that was at sort of 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. And I'm just thinking, what I'm thinking is, fuck me, what has just happened?
Yeah.
It was surreal. And then, so I had to process that. And then, I was told, why don't you go off sick? And I said, well, I'm not going off sick. And then I wasn't allowed into the homicide office. They made a big thing of clearing the homicide office because Hannibal Lecter was coming in. I'm not sure what I was going to do. And then just put in a room for 3 months and sat there. And then I was charged and then convicted. And I'd put in my resignation before I was charged because I said, clearly you guys don't want me here, so I'm going to resign. And I was told by a deputy and an assistant commissioner, no, Jubes, don't retire, don't retire. Bullshit. These are the people that went after me. And when I put my notification in to retire, I said to these guys, and I knew them, and I knew them well, knew them for a long time. And I said, look, there's no animosity. Yeah, the world changes. My time is.
Was that true for you? You felt truly no animosity?
I could have kept it publicly internally. I don't want to walk away bitter. I really don't. So it was probably me trying to channel what I wanted to hold my emotion at. And I put it in writing. I said, there'll be no animosity. I'll be a positive advocate for the cops, and I'll help out on any investigations that are still outstanding. Happy days. I'll move on to the next chapter of my life. But then after that went in, then I was charged, and then stuff was put in the papers. So when it was put in the papers, that just really annoyed me. Mm. Really annoyed me that people were really trying to just shame me and humiliate me. And so there were some low points in life. When I was convicted, because of the conviction, I didn't have the option of being a private investigator, because that was certainly on the table and people had approached me about doing stuff. So I could have carved out a career there. But that was, for some reason, the courts wanted to record the conviction, even though I'd never been in trouble before. So they recorded the conviction, that shut down. And then there were some approaches from a whole variety of media organisations on what to do. And that was probably my saviour, in that I had something that, okay, this sounds cool. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind doing some of that. So I looked around what really interests me, and I signed with News Corp, and I signed with Channel 9, mm-hmm. which was, so I had two things going at the time. And I was a babe in the woods when it came to journalism. Yeah. And I know that I was sort of pitched in a level higher than what I deserved, because the first article I wrote, it was on the front page of a paper or whatever. And I was so, I wish I paid more attention to English at school.
No, I'm sure there are probably a lot of skills from policing that cross over to journalism, especially when it comes to interviewing, reading people, being curious, being empathetic. They're kind of like the tent poles and the crux of what you do as a good journalist. You want to uncover the truth. You want to tell good stories. You want to get to the core of who people are. So I imagine a lot of it is the same, but having a front page story is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. And like I'm thinking, I don't deserve this. And because I'm a big believer in paying your dues. I was fortunate that I had a great mentor, Claire Harvey, the Sunday Telegraph at the time, and Mick Carroll, and they welcomed me in there, and Channel 9 with 60 Minutes and Under Investigation. It was good. And they accepted that, I'm learning. I'd put in a lot of effort. The podcast got up and running, and that went.
Podcast host of the year?
Yeah, and like it was bizarre.
Does it shock you because you think that the standard isn't there, or that it could be better? Like, what is it that is uncomfortable for you to celebrate, I guess, your success?
I look at it this way. I as good as my last podcast. Mm-hmm. So I'm still getting nervous. I did a big podcast yesterday. I was doing one this morning. Mm-hmm. I still get nervous before I do the podcast, but I put the effort in and put the work in. What I enjoyed about the podcast was that it was a long form conversation, because when I was in the police and the media and I see the headlines and sometimes I think, it's giving the wrong impression. So in the long form conversation, it allowed people to tell their story.
Totally.
And I pushed back. I think there was a perception that I'd come in and do the gotcha moments on the podcast and there's a headline, talk about this case, says this, says that. And I was fortunate that Claire backed me on this. I've said, look, here's the first tape of, I interviewed a mate that I was a partner with for 10 years in the cops. It went for about an hour and a half, and Claire liked it. And then there was a thought, we condense it down to half an hour, and we're going, well, why?
You lose the magic of the conversation.
Lose the conversation. So that was good. A funny story there, but because it was my mate, Jason Evers. So shout out to Jason. We worked together for 10 years. Mm-hmm. We loved each other, but we fought a lot. It was like a relationship.
Always away.
Yeah. I said, can you help me out? They want me to do a demo tape for a podcast. Mm-hmm. And he's gone, yep. And so I phoned him. He lives up the coast. Mm-hmm. Recording it and recording on my phone. I clearly didn't learn from what I was charged with. But recording it. And then we spoke for about 2 hours and it was gold. We went really well. I said, thanks. And I'll send that to News Corp. And this is a demo of what I think the podcast should sound like. And then with my technical skills, like this is why I laugh so much. I lost it. I had it on the phone and I tried to transfer it on the computer and I completely lost it. So I had to phone him up about 4 o'clock in the morning the next morning, because I said I'd bring it in today, and said, Jason, what do you want? And I said, you know how we did that podcast last night that finished about 10 o'clock? Yes. well, can we do it again? Because I've lost it. And full credit to him.
He did it?
He did it.
Wow.
So he put up with it again. So
I Catch Killers, we need to thank Jason. He was the start of it all.
He was the start of it all. Wow. It could have ended there. But no, I've enjoyed it. I'm getting to meet interesting people. I'm getting to meet a lot of people on the other side of policing. And that's been an eye-opener for me.
That's what you said before. I totally can relate. That's why I love this form, because I have worked on the other side of like hard news journalism, where it's all about the title and the clickbait and the fear mongering. And like, obviously we do need news in the world. I get that. But I think there is something so special about just providing a space for someone to come in, feel safe and vulnerable enough to share their story and not feel like it's going to be taken out of context or not feel like it's got an agenda behind it. It's just a platform for them to show up.
I think that's a very good approach to this. And it is a new world, isn't it? The podcast world. Like there's so many podcasts out there. But what I like about it is that the listeners, I say that I'm giving the listeners the opportunity of forming their own view. Now, I'll have a view that might come across in the podcast, but you form your own view. And I've had a lot of people thank me for opening their eyes up to different perspectives, because I think when I first started, people would have thought that it was just going to be, me speaking to ex-cops going, and then we locked up this bad guy and then
like
we did that.
A bro sort of bro chat.
Yeah. Mm. And, we do that occasionally. In the very first season, there was a Aboriginal lady. She was a police officer, Jaron Badgett, that grew up in Redfern on the block. I just happened, after what happened to me in the cops, walking along the city, kicking stones, and she approached me.
Wow.
And we got to talking, and she had just left the police. So we shared something in common. And I said to Jaron, could you come on the podcast? And she heard the first couple of ones with these big hitting ex-homicide detectives and high-profile cops and stories. And she's gone, no one will be interested. And I've gone, this will be perfect, Jaron. We're going to open people's perspective, looking at it, because a fascinating story that she joined the police because she didn't want her family treated the way that she was as a kid growing up in the block. And she was the first female Aboriginal that grew up in the block that joined the police. Great lady. She came on and did this podcast, and then we stay in contact, and she'd say that people are still reaching out, that 50-year-old men saying, I never really liked all this stuff about Aboriginals, but you've changed my view, and stuff like that. And they're the things that you just open people's minds up, not lecturing to them, just let them form their own opinion.
It's just giving those voices a platform as well, I think, that are often marginalised in traditional media. It's giving people a voice, and I think that's what I come back to is like, how can I show up for these people who need it, who don't have an opportunity to tell their story? And how can I just sit back and let them say what they need to say and gently steer and guide it? But also, it's not about me. It's about the guest. So you're already on your way to being an amazing journalist. You're doing it.
Well, I think the thing is, it's the guests, and that's what I want it to be. Like the guests are the story for it, because I'd like to just crawl away from all the spotlights sometimes. Yeah, I don't crave it. Like it's just, it's there. I accept it now. And it's easier that I don't want to be the story. I want the people that are I'm interviewing. And that's what I basically get people on the podcast that I want to hear their story.
Totally.
And I
think it's a bit of a selfish pursuit deep down, because you're like, I just want to ask this person these questions I'm curious about, and hopefully other people like them too.
Exactly. But it helps you, certainly speaking to some, I've had some notorious criminals on the podcast and, we've become quite friendly since and stay in contact. And
I imagine that's quite a strange experience. I did want to ask, what's it been like speaking to people that you've investigated or even arrested? Have you ever been scared? Or it's an odd experience to kind of then remove the system and talk as humans, I suppose.
It has been, like, I think the first couple that I did, there was some pushback in that the cops would be saying, why is he talking to that person? The crooks would be saying, why is he talking to Jubilant? That type of thing. I think now, and there'd still be people that resent anyone that speaks to me in the criminal world, like, why would you speak to him? And I'm sure there's cops going, why would you give that person airtime? But I think there's now an acceptance that I'm not walking away from the fact I was a cop. I was a cop and I stand by everything I've done. Mm-hmm. But I'm prepared to sit down and have a chat with you guys and see what you've got to say. And quite honestly, that's been the most enjoyable,
rewarding.
Rewarding. Mm. Yeah. A rewarding thing that I've done is that just show people that crime is not black and white. Like, if I can help people educate that everyone's got a story, and let's try and open our minds up to it a little bit more, because I never get tough on crime, do this, do that. Sometimes there's a need for it, but there's other ways to fight crime, and that's, you know, I think I'm making a difference by, you know, hopefully educating people
totally.
On that.
I'm sure the people that write in confirm that, and I'm sure you hear from people all around the world who have their lives changed or their opinion or their belief systems changed by just listening to the conversations.
Yeah, yeah. And that little things like that mean so much. Like, where do you get your reward in life? What's your purpose in life? Well, you're just trying to be a good person. Mm-hmm. Yeah, none of us are perfect. We make mistakes. I make mistakes every day, but I just try to learn from the mistakes and, you know, not do them again.
Something that we didn't touch on that I actually pretty much do with every single guest, but I just didn't feel the need to do it today, and I'd love to give you the opportunity if you'd like to, is I often delve into like early life and experiences, but I know you've got an amazing book and there it's out there. But I guess if you were to sit down with young Gary now and kind of give him a heads up on what was to come or give him any advice, would you firstly tell him what he was in store for? And if you chose to do that, I guess what would be some words of advice or some messages you'd want to get across?
My father was very tough on me when I was growing up. He's made me the person I am now. Life will hit you in the face time and time again. You got to have that resilience to be able to handle it, because no one's going to go through life unscathed or unscarred. I try to prepare my kids with that. I try to give it a little bit more of a fluffy side. Yeah, parenting has changed, but I still want young people to be resilient, knowing that life is going to kick you in the teeth time and time again, and you just got to get up and take your bruises. So that's the type of thing. And it's not, you can have both. You can be tough, but you can be soft as well. And that's what I try to instill in it. If anyone that I had potential to influence, I'd say it's all right to be hard. Sometimes you have got to be hard, but don't lose the humanity. And I think if you can go through that. The other thing that's important, and I'm learning it and I can do it, but you struggle with it sometimes, you've got to be able to laugh at yourself too. Like, if you can laugh at yourself, you're halfway there to getting the world beat, because you just don't take it all too seriously. Life is short. Okay, that happened. Yeah, well, I fucked up there, but you get on with it. And I think that would be a good message for a young person.
Did having children change you? I imagine you were working at the time. Did having children kind of change you or worry you about the world they were coming into, or any of those thoughts and feelings? I guess your kids are grown up now. Yeah. Like, what was that experience like? And then reflecting on your own dad being quite tough on you, did you find that you wanted to be the same or the opposite?
Yeah, I wanted to be tough with my kids. So I wanted them to have that resilience, not destroy them, not break them, but be able to stand up for themselves, articulate their thoughts and get that across. But also wanted them to enjoy life. Like, I didn't want them to be, you know, too serious. I think if anything in my life, I probably took everything too serious. Like that was
the
me.
Nature of your role, I suppose. You had to.
Yeah, and that's sort of probably why I gravitated towards it. People close to me said I could bring some kindness to the victims' families, but I was so hard on the people closer to me. And yeah, that makes me reflect and think, yeah, well, maybe there's truth in that. But yeah, you get out of life what you put into it, I honestly believe. And that's something that a work ethic that my father and mother played a part. She was the soft one and the dad was the hard one. But you get out of life what you put into it. And I like to think people have still got that view. There's no shortcuts in life. You know, to become a detective, to run the cases I did, that was hard graft. That was a lot of work. Doing the podcast that I'm doing, I put a shitload of work into the podcast to prepare for them, because I try to improve it each time. And I listen to old podcasts and I cringe and go, eh, but.
That's a good sign, because then you know you're growing and changing, I think. If you were to stay the same, I mean, your success speaks volumes, but it's because it's becoming better and better and more engaging, and I'm trying to do the same. I cringe at everything I post.
Yes.
But I think that's a good sign, because it means I'm learning and I have better judgment around what I can do.
Yeah, I think self-critiquing your work and striving for something better is not a bad bad thing at all. And
unless it tips into, I guess, you being so hard on yourself that you don't celebrate yourself at all and you never think you're good enough.
That's where you've got to get that balance and find that balance. And it's tricky. You know, like I'm sitting here with all my theories on life. Like I keep saying, I'll make mistakes, but you just try and learn from things. And and I'll never say what happened to me in the cops was good. Well, I've just said it, but I probably would have died in the police. There would have been another case I had to work on because I just didn't. I was a dog with a bone. I didn't know how to let go. I would have stayed. So on reflection, what's happened to me, well, it's opened a whole new world. It's given me a second career. I've still got the energy and the excitement. I get excited That's with wonderful. What I'm doing. So I'm happy there. I feel for, obviously, the Tyrrell matter, the state of disarray that appears to be in, that hopefully that'll resolve. There's a coronial inquest coming up and hopefully the truth will come out in that. And the other matters that I haven't been able to stick with, but I stay in contact with the families and help them when I can.
It's wonderful to hear. We'll wrap up soon. I guess I'd love to hear just some closing questions. Yep. Other than becoming a florist, what would you like this next chapter of your life to be? And just touching on before we spoke about you having children, I heard a wonderful interview where you said that your kids understand the sacrifices that you made because they know that you were with people that needed it. That your time more, something beautiful along the lines of that. I guess, what sort of legacy do you want to leave and what work are you focused on doing in this next chapter of your life for your kids and for everyone?
Well, what the kids said, and that I get emotional even thinking about that because that they sent it just at the right time where all this shit was happening and you start to doubt yourself and they sent something like that and I think, oh, well, that's, yeah.
It was worth it.
All of a sudden I felt another, 3 feet taller. What do I hope to achieve? I want to be able to enjoy myself. Like I'm at that point. I want to be able to enjoy myself and still find the passion to do things of interest. So there's a couple of things that we've done 2 books and co-wrote with Dan Box. There's talk of potentially doing a third. After the first, I promised myself I'd never do a second. And
Here we go. Yep, that's always the way.
Yeah, I'll see about that. But yeah, the work that doing with the podcast and other opportunities that coming in with journalism.
Maybe another Underbelly series.
No, I'll check with Matt whether he's available.
Drop your script in that you've written and see if they'll take it up.
Hey, one thing I have done is consulted with some fictional writers and fictional TV series and have been out. And I've enjoyed that because I really do enjoy, and that's probably answering the question, I want to work with creative people in that in policing, it's fairly contained what you can do. And I think I got criticised for some of the things I did because it was thinking outside the square, but that was where I was trying to find my creative side. I'm enjoying in the media and this whole world that meeting some interesting people. And last year and early this year, I think it was, goes so quickly, a live tour with a friend, Rob Carlton. He's an actor. So we were on stage at, and the first show was sold out Enmore Theatre on a Saturday night. And I was so nervous. And working with Rob, like he was just, I was like a sponge. He just taught me so much because he's been an actor and a writer and that his whole life. He knows the stage and just things that he was telling me.
Yep.
And I thought I would never, ever be in that position. And I was, and it was something I was proud of and I enjoyed it. And I'm thinking, how good's this? So little things like that, little challenges.
Just being a lifelong learner as well.
100%. And I don't know what's around the corner, but I'll give it a go and see what happens.
Thank you so much for your time. I'm honestly so grateful. I think you're such an incredibly humble person despite having a very successful career. You seem incredibly kind. Your focus on empathy, I think, is quite inspiring. And yeah, I'm just very, very grateful for your work and for the work that you have done, not only in the police force, but just providing people a platform to tell their stories as well. I think it's so needed and so important. Thank you.
Thanks, Georgia, and thanks for having me on.
Of course, there is one final question. We have a closing tradition on this podcast. Every single guest is asked the same question.
Can't sing.
Famous last words. I'll be monetizing a song if you do sing it on my podcast. No, every guest is asked the same question. You can answer in as many words as you like. Yep. That question is, Gary, what is the meaning of life?
To go as hard as you can. Achieve things you want to achieve, don't hurt anyone, and enjoy yourself.
Incredible. Thank you. We'll leave it at that. And I'll leave all the resources to Gary's podcast, your book, your Instagram, and anywhere else we can direct the audience to your tickets to your show that's coming up in the show notes. And thank you again so much for being here.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please let me know who you'd love to hear from next, or if you have a story to share, I'd love to get in touch with you. You can connect directly with me on Instagram at lifechatspodcast, one word. And every review and share really does help so much in the early days of building a podcast. So if you've enjoyed this conversation, please share it on social media, or you can snap a pic of where you might be listening and jump onto Apple Podcasts and give us a review. I really do appreciate the support. More than you know. Have a beautiful morning, afternoon, or evening wherever you may be listening in the world. I'm Georgia May, and this is Life Chats.